Hello and welcome to another episode of FinTech Stories, the OSINT podcast which explores the latest legal and regulatory developments, trends, and hot topics in the FinTech sector from across the globe. I'm Miroslav Djuric, Senior Associate in our Financial Services Regulatory Practice, and in today's episode, we'll explore one of the most consequential developments in the financial services industry nowadays, which promises to reshape the financial markets we know, tokenization of financial assets. I am very pleased to be joined today by Josh Peschko, Global Head of Compliance and Regulatory Strategy at Talos, a US-based institutional trading technology provider that delivers infrastructure for trading and managing digital assets. Founded in 2018, the company offers an end-to-end platform that connects buy-side and sell-side institutions such as prime brokers, OTC desks, and exchanges with a broader crypto ecosystem through a single interface, covering pretty much everything from price discovery, execution through to portfolio management, treasury settlement, and post-trade analytics. Josh, welcome to our show. Tell us something about yourself and what you do.
Sure. It's always great to talk to you again, my friend. It's great to be here. Yeah, that's a great introduction of Talos. We have offices all over the globe, and being in the digital asset space for 8 years now, we've seen a lot of evolution. The founders of this firm and the majority of the people that work here grew up in traditional finance. And their jobs in those roles were to build the trading technology that many of the large firms run on now. In the past few years, we've been working with these firms to bring them to the digital side and really combining all the workflows. You know, my job day to day is to chat with interesting people like yourself, Miroslav, and try to understand the market and understand the problems that our customers have during this transition and really try to navigate the intersection of the compliance and regulatory space to make sure that, you know, everybody's is doing the right thing and we're building in the right direction.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting area to be active in, isn't it? Well, let's kick off. I mean, everyone who was following the financial services sector in recent years has almost certainly stumbled across the topic of tokenization of financial assets. Ever since the ICO bull market, we know from back in 2017-2018, the industry has been looking to explore the benefits that the use of DLT could bring to the financial market transactions, primarily in terms of the efficiency improvement, so from time over operational to cost efficiency, obviously. This comes against the backdrop that the existing financial markets run on a legacy financial market infrastructure that were not designed a few decades ago in a way that would provide for instant clearing and settlement to begin with. And for this, there are many different reasons, so from regulatory to technical reasons, but we can come to that a bit later today. The numbers, when it comes to tokenization, also seem to support the growing industry interest in this topic. According to the latest report from BCG and Ripple, the total market cap of tokenized financial assets could easily hit $18.9 trillion US dollars by 2033. But Josh, let's kick off with some basics. For those who are not familiar with the topic, when we talk about tokenization of financial assets, what exactly do we mean by that?
Yeah. The past 6 months, especially, you know, the term tokenization has been around for years, but there wasn't a lot of meat to it, right? But the past 6 months, the conversations that are happening, it's no longer about the price of a certain token. It really is how we're actually utilizing this technology. When you strip it down, right, you record who owns an asset. It's a bond, a fund share, a T-bill, and you're doing this on a blockchain instead of in a database inside of a bank, which is how it happens now, right? The token is the ownership of record. The asset underneath of it doesn't change, right? So a tokenized treasury is still a treasury. What changes is the plumbing, right? So the question is, you know, why does this matter, right? So to take a step back, to frame it in the U.S., there's an entity probably most people don't even know or have heard of called Seed & Co. Seed & Co. is the central nominee for the DTCC, right? Seed holds the legal title for nearly all publicly traded securities in the U.S., over $100 trillion, right, for one nominee, right? So when you bought a share of Apple, you actually own a beneficial interest in a share that Seed holds for your broker, who holds it for you, right? Sometimes there can be like seven links in that chain. Tokenization collapses all of that, right? If the chain is the record, the trading layer and the ownership layer become one, right? There's nothing to reconcile overnight, because nothing is sitting in multiple places. And there's really kind of two models we can get into where how something kind of gets tokenized, right? There's an issuer-sponsored model where a company is going to issue a security natively on chain. So instead of going through the public markets the traditional way, they're going to issue a token. So the token is the real thing that's coming from the issuer instead of the stock. Same sort of underlying exposure, but the issuer is the one that's kind of doing this, right? The other side is a third-party sponsored model, right? Where someone who is not the issuer is going to hold the asset and they're going to issue a token giving you the exposure to it, right? And that distinction is really a whole different risk picture. In the first, your relationship is with the company, right? And in the second, there's an extra entity in there in the middle. You know, it's important to know who that is and know what happens if something fails in that. So these are two different models that are actively being discussed.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up. I mean, just for folks on this side of the pond, so in terms of central securities depositories, you mentioned, so equivalent in the EU, for instance, would be like Euroclear or Clearstream, pretty much a central entity that registers all newly issued shares and pretty much serves as the main register for these securities. Now, the big question, there is a lot of promises when it comes to tokenization, a lot of noise, so to say. But what are the actual advantages that tokenization brings to the table? So now, looking at these legacy infrastructures, talking about CSDs, both in the US, across UK, EU, you name it, what is the real value proposition, Josh, in your opinion?
Yeah, I'll try to separate it from kind of the marketing pitch from the mechanics, right? Because I think there's this popular story, you know, and I think this is pretty a pretty universal story around crypto as well, around this sort of like retail liberation, you know, 24/7 trading, fees are going to collapse and you just get a wallet and you're in. But there's a real tell to that, right? Like US retail equity commissions have been zero for years, right? You're not going to compress a zero fee, right? So I think why this is gaining so much momentum is the real value is in the back of that trade. So settlement goes from T plus one now to atomic, right, to instant. The cash and the asset will swap instantly, right? A collateral gets really mobile, right? And this is, again, in institutional context, this is really important. So today, settlement takes time. Because of that, firms have to over-collateralize as a buffer, right? There's been surveys from the industry that estimate around like 7%, right, of a buffer that is required for some of these trades they're doing. That's money is not earning. Right, there's no yield to that. You're just posting that for collateral. So the biggest thing for dealers, right, is freeing up. You know, it could be an estimate of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for some, you know, very large firms. That's the actual prize, and that's why institutions are now moving so fast and really building toward this. It's not so much because retail has asked, right? It's really because they see value in a smoother back of the trade aspect of this whole thing. So, you know, like, you know, the honest pitch really is like tokenization is an institutional efficiency story. That's kind of it, right? There is retail access side effects, but the plumbing upgrade is really the point of this whole thing.
Yeah, it's pretty much the main added value that we can see is behind the scenes, right? So this plumbing getting more efficient, you know, institutions getting more breathing room when it comes to, you know, operation and this instant so-called atomic settlement that could pretty much spark all of that. But speaking about tokenization, I mean, just in the media, you know, different institutions follow different paths, but we see that in terms of different use cases, just, you know, front end, there are a lot of different use cases that we can talk about. As you said, like on the retail side, we saw that many argued that tokenization could be a tool that could bring liquidity to traditionally illiquid assets, let's say like shares in private companies. Especially in recent years, we have a lot of very, very valuable companies staying private for longer. I mean, until the last week. But still, there are a lot of them in this IPO pipeline, and there was a big question whether they're going to go public or not. And hence, you know, some have seen tokenization is a tool that could potentially bring liquidity to private markets, but not only private markets, but also some other corners of the financial service industry. For instance, you know, tokenization of some real world assets, sort of, you know, like enabling fractional ownership on some highly, highly valued pieces of like art or precious metals and so on. How do you see this? I mean, obviously the main added value, the focus everyone needs to have is on the back end, but on the front end, speaking about different use cases, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, the viability The answer is yes, right? Does tokenization unlock some of this stuff to some degree? Absolutely, right? Is this solved? Definitely not yet, right? There's a number of reasons why something could be illiquid for a lot of private assets. Part of that is could be solved by tokenization, right? Ownership records are chunky. Transfers are very slow, right? Like the there's that's some of the bigger drivers of why this stuff takes a while and why it's illiquid. If you put that cap table on chain and you can move ownership in seconds and slice it in a more fractional way, that is a real unlock. Does it totally open up access? Probably not, right? The token may be permissionless, but there's still KYC requirements. When you're dealing with private securities, there's going to be accreditation checks that need to be done. Reg S, is a big one in the US. Those walls are going to stay intact, right? So, quote unquote, anyone can trade kind of quietly becomes like anyone in the right jurisdiction where it's legal who clears accreditation can trade, which is the same story that happens now. So the binding constraint isn't so much the technology, it's going to be the legal wrapper, which is the same thing we're dealing with now, right? The chain solves the transfer problem, but not so much the who's allowed to hold this problem. Now, like that determination of who's allowed to trade could be done quicker, right? You could build in some of these controls that are very slow and manual into the smart contract itself, but I don't think we're there yet, and I think companies are trying to figure that out. But that's, the next step around this is going to be building some of this stuff into the smart contract.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, there is also one another area of the financial services industry where we see a very strong push for tokenization, and I would say especially like over the last like 12 months, which is asset management, and in particular, tokenization of money market funds. From BlackRock's Biddle to some other similar products coming from big global fund managers, many incumbent institutions appear to be betting big time on tokenized money market funds. On the retail side, at least in Europe, I mean, including UK, we have a very poor money market fund adoption rate among retail investors. And this is an area where many see tokenized money market funds as a liquid instrument that could unlock trillions of debt capital sitting on low interest savings accounts of retail investors. I mean, just simply because a lot of retail investors are not even familiar with this concept. Further, in the wholesale space, the use of tokenized money market funds could potentially also enable more efficient treasury management across international groups, easier collateral mobility, and collateral management for corporates. What are your thoughts on this exactly?
Yeah, Biddle's definitely the poster child, right? Billions in tokenized money market fund exposure, and most crucially, it's accepted as collateral on a lot of digital asset exchanges, right? So you hold a yield-bearing fund and post the same instrument as margin in real time on a Sunday, which is something you can't do now with other traditional money market funds, right? Those are going to be stuck in more of a settlement cycle that we talked about as well with the equities. On the retail dead capital piece, I think you're right. There's an obviously enormous pool of low yield accounts out there. I know I have one. I'm sure many of the listeners do, right? If there's instant ways to earn more yield on the cash that's sitting there, I think everybody wants that. Without a settlement delay is the key piece there between the cash and the tokenized money market fund. Having a high interest savings account or anything else that you might be doing with your cash on a retail side, there is settlement issues there. You might be worried because it's not instant where you can bring it back into your checking account and actually use it. So I think part of that is more maybe a structural problem with the banks who offer those and making that process seamless to opt in. You can always create a product that seems perfect for this. But I do think it's going to be an education challenge, and effort from the banks of the world to make sure that people understand this option's out there and to make it as seamless as possible. So it would really be a no-brainer to opt in to have your cash move into a money market fund. A tokenization money market fund is the solve for that. This is not something I think that would be easy to do, and it's not for traditional accounts into a traditional money market fund right now. But I think we'll see how this evolves. There's a lot of optimism, but there hasn't been a big up adoption yet on the retail side. And I still,
Yeah.
I going back to my point, I think it's more of an education aspect and integration with the systems themselves.
Yeah, it definitely takes time, and I mean it's an evolving space. But I, in my view at least, I mean as someone coming also personally from the crypto industry, the most fascinating part of the entire tokenized money market fund story is the fact that we see that some tokenized money market funds appear to be becoming a true challengers to stablecoins, don't they? As a yield-bearing collateral instruments that are not subject to this heavily criticized interest-granting ban at the issuer level that applies to stablecoin issuers. So both in the US under Genius Act, but also under the emerging UK regulatory framework on qualified stablecoins, and obviously MiCA in the EU, which pretty much started this entire ban. What are your thoughts on this? Have asset managers indeed found a very convenient, so to say, like a backdoor to offer a more appealing version of yield-bearing tokenized assets that could be used, I mean, amongst other things, as financial collateral?
Yeah, the story is very different when you talk about institutions, right? Where it's not so much education. When you're talking, you know, billions of dollars, you're motivated and you're willing to put in work to find the most optimal way to get yield with your cash, right? You know, the word backdoor is a fun one, and I think I mostly agree. If you can get a token that holds value, it pays yield, it you can post it as collateral, you know, that's what you want, what your stablecoin. And if you can't get that, then you know you're willing to do this through a fund, right? That is it a backdoor? You know, nobody's really hiding anything. Like there's a prospectus or you're still issuing a fund, right? But there's definitely some key differences, I think, as well, right? Like, you know, funds are allowed to pay yield. That's great. And that's the whole point of a fund, right? But oftentimes the money market funds in general, they're not maybe made up of one thing. Now, they're all different, right? But there's rules around it, but around duration and things like that, around what can be in a money market fund. But the devil can be in the details sometimes there. And, you know, in prior jobs I've had, people have spent a lot of time on the risk teams really looking into a variety of different money market funds. And you might think, oh, these are all the same. They're going to be, you know, pegged at a dollar. And there really could be big differences in terms of the risk profile that can still fit within a money market fund, especially in really volatile times. You know, they have NAVs. They have redemption mechanisms that maybe behave differently under stress, right? So it's a really interesting space, and the push and pull between regulators and the industry around kind of yield-bearing stablecoins is fascinating. So I think there's a lot of ways to get yield on your cash, and money market funds, a tokenized money market fund seems to be the most optimal right now compared to a stablecoin that isn't allowed to issue yield. But we'll see how the industry evolves.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, talking about money market funds, they've been, you know, subject to heavy regulatory constraints for years, for decades. I mean, both on this side of the pond, but also in the US. And it's a very mature industry. And as you correctly said, I mean, the underlying portfolio is sometimes much more complex than what I can see. So we're gonna definitely be following this part of the tokenization story. But moving on, given that we are both very much involved in the regulatory side, I'm afraid that despite the very interesting topic that we went through so far, we cannot skip the regulatory angle of the whole tokenization topic, can't we? Across the EU, UK, and lately especially the US, we see that regulators and policymakers are increasingly trying to keep pace with technological developments and appear to be hearing the industry voices and sort of trying to find ways to facilitate adoption of tokenized financial assets. However, policymakers across the EU, UK, and US appear to be moving at different speeds when it comes to this. Starting from this side of the pond, the EU rolled out its so-called DLT pilot regime back in March 2023, which was pretty much the first sandbox-like regulatory framework, which in a nutshell allowed existing financial institutions to use DLT for securities trading purposes. So primarily, this was addressed at secondary market trading. The regime had, so to say, modest success, especially because of very low thresholds that were set by the EU lawmakers back in the day. And now we see that as of December last year, when the EU Commission has published a legislative proposal that shall amend the original DLT pilot regulation, there is some willingness to increase these thresholds and also the expand the scope of this regime with the aim of pretty much enabling it to scale in a better way. In the UK, the FCA has also, together with the Bank of England, taken a somewhat different approach to the EU, but also created the so-called Digital Securities Sandbox, which went live in late 2024, and that will be operational until December 28. Unlike the EU regime, DSS is built around, so to say, a gated structure, so that participants, they progress slowly through different series of stages, and the level of permitted live activity is increased at each gate. DSS is also, like DLT pilot regime, open to any regulated and unregulated entity based in the UK. On the other hand, in the EU, we see that the sandbox is open only to pretty much to MiFID firms, and the thresholds are also considerably more generous. Over the last couple of months, we saw that the FCA was working on, has published a number of consultation papers, first on the tokenization in the fund management space, and then later also consultation paper on, so pretty much the it was call for input on the tokenization in wholesale markets. But Josh, despite these obviously very interesting developments on here in Europe and in the UK, I believe, conscious of the depth of the US capital markets, the latest developments in the US are something that everyone is paying very close attention to. And arguably, some recent policy making moves on this side of the pond come sort of like as a reaction to them, at least in my view. Would you please run us through on the approach to tokenization that regulators and policymakers in the US have taken lately?
Yeah, the U.S. went from, you know, hostility to silence, really, to a really deliberate sequence clearing of obstacles. And the pace we're on right now is really hard to keep up with, even if you're doing it full time, even with the help of multiple Claude bots, you know, looking for things all the time. Start with, you know, the foundational principle that the SEC and CFC stated jointly this year, I think, is the best place, right? A security is a security, whether it's on paper, in the database, on a blockchain, on-chain, off-same rules, right? That one sentence killed a lot of discussion for years, really, where, oh, this is different, it's on-chain, like the kind of hand-waving, right? So we've level set that, and that was a good first step, at least so we can then start building, right? And then these building blocks, some of these, you know, I'm sure the listeners are familiar with, the Genius Act gave stablecoins a federal framework, right? The Clarity Act, it was passed in the House, now Senate has a markup. That's going to tackle a lot of the securities versus commodity questions, really, the, you know, who handles this, the SEC or the CFTC. We live in a country here in the U.S. where we're lucky to have two different regulators who are powerful and well-funded. Not every country has that. I think most countries have kind of one financial regulator, which makes things a little bit easier. But the fact they're working together really is not normal and a really positive sign. You know, the things that have happened, the CFTC has explicitly blessed tokenized treasuries and money market funds as collateral for futures and swaps, right? So taking the tokenized collateral from an experiment really to something that a regulator expects you to be able to handle and is allowing you to handle. You know, the most striking thing I think really happened in the past few weeks with the SEC proposing to rescind Rule 611 of Regulation Reg NMS, which is the trades rule, more normally known through here. So for listeners that might not be familiar, right, this is a rule that's been a backbone of U.S. equity trading, I think since like 2005, right? So every trade has to respect the best displayed price across all exchanges at the moment of execution. It sounds sensible, but it's a real structural barrier for trading tokenized equities on chain. Like, you know, an automated market maker, an AMM, the on-chain mechanism that prices a lot of these trades, it just physically can't comply with this regulation, right? It's executing against a pricing curve at block speed, and it just can't go check NASDAQ's quote at the same microsecond and just halt itself. So the rule and technology were just incompatible. And this is something that the crypto industry has been discussing with regulators for some time now, right? So I think if you watch the sequencing in the U.S., it's very deliberate, right? They're proposing to remove rules that on-chain trading can't satisfy. That's kind of step one. So get rid of the stuff that might be holding crypto back or digital assets back in terms of tokenization. Lean into your classic kind of best execution requirements, which is what the proposal has said, right? These are principle-based duties at the broker level you know, they're satisfied through a regular review. I'm sure many of the listeners are, you know, aware of what Best X is and what it takes to achieve Best X. And a lot of compliance teams especially are going to be very aware of that. So remove the rules from the actual exchanges themselves and put them on, put the onus on the brokers to achieve best execution and prove that. And then handle the venue registration questions in a different manner, right? So the SEC has signaled they're going to do this through some sort of an innovation exemption. We're still waiting, you know, with bated breath on whatever this looks like. You know, it was weeks away a few months ago, so any day, hopefully, something will come out. You know, and that'll be really interesting to see exactly how they're approaching this. So, you know, to take a step back, clear the hardest obstacles first, then handle the plumbing. But I think the direction where we're going is unmistakable here.
Oh, that's really interesting. I mean, these targeted deviations from standard securities regulations are pretty much paramount and the key precondition for the functioning of these DLT sandboxes, which is the approach that was taken also by the EU policymakers back in 2022-23 when DLT pilot regime went live, and also by the FCA and Bank of England in the UK, which have a bit more, so to say, maneuver space in terms of, you know, identifying and then disapplying certain requirements under the UK financial regulation. But I think your point on Best X is also something that is very interesting, especially for EU listeners, given that DLT pilot regime is now going through a reform. And one of the points that is going to be addressed is going to go pretty much in a similar direction. So it's really interesting to see that US policymakers already have that on their, so to say, so on the agenda. I mean, there are a lot of activities related to tokenized financial assets, but I would just like to stick with one with you for a second, which is custody of tokenized securities. I mean, custody of crypto assets on one hand and custody of tokenized securities are on the other hand, despite pretty much sharing same infrastructure layer, are regulated activities that are totally different in some jurisdictions, at least in the EU and the UK. However, we see that some policymakers and regulators, for instance, FCA in the UK, is potentially thinking of applying the rules on safeguarding of crypto assets under the new emerging crypto asset regulatory framework in the UK to apply to safeguarding of relevant specified investment crypto assets, which are pretty much tokenized versions of, let's say, securities like equities or bonds. So one practical question. So here we see clash of traditional regulatory frameworks with the new technical reality. So from your perspective, what are your thoughts on the use of the so-called commingled wallets, so shared custody infrastructure that can be used for both for custody of traditional crypto assets like altcoins and as well as tokenized securities?
Yeah, technology and law really pulls in opposite directions here, right? Like it engineers ask all the time, right? You know, why are we do we need to run two separate custody stacks of the same tech? It's duplicative and expensive. Like from an engineering standpoint, you know, you understand why certain companies might be pushing for the commingling. You know, in reality, asset types carry different rules, and the wallet tech might be identical, but the rules certainly are, and those rules are there for a reason. You know, tokenized security drags along security law obligations, segregation, customer protection, specific record keeping. Now, we just talked about some rules that are being unwound or thought about differently. Is there room there? There's probably some to take some stuff out. But, you know, there's different regimes. When you start commingling, you know, in one container under two rule books, and which I can't imagine are ever totally exactly the same, when something goes wrong, it's going to be really difficult to know instantly like which rules apply. So aligning the rules makes sense. You know, fighting for a shared infrastructure, I think, just me personally, it might be, you know, a losing battle. You know, I think it's a mistake to let operational convenience, you know, quietly erase some important distinctions and important rules that are there, because that's really what protects clients, you know, when it comes to a default. The business of custody in general, you know, especially in an institutional sense and certainly a retail sense, is so critical, right? And making sure your assets are safe is really the most important thing, in terms of, you know, some of the decisions you can make is what, you know, what custodian you have. So, you know, I think there's always going to be a need for real strong custody rules, and the commingling of assets really could muddy the waters a bit, and you know, allow maybe some players in that can build fast that maybe aren't as secure, and put a real risk, I think, in the whole ecosystem.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more because I also think like it's one thing to sort of, try to align, let's say, safeguarding requirements with the underlying infrastructure and technology. Like, for instance, it's the direction of travel that the FCA appears to be heading into. So pretty much aligning these rules with the new technological reality. And the other is, just opening the floodgates to like commingled wallets and pretty much storing in a crypto wallet anything one could come up with. Yeah, so let's zoom out for a second maybe and look at the bigger picture, Josh. We see that many institutions are experimenting with DLT-based securities issuance and trading across the board. So let's say from small startups a couple of years ago, but also lately, we see increasingly commercial banks and also some large investments in international financial institutions like EBRD, AIIB, World Bank, and so on entering the space. We have also advised a number of entities when structuring and offering tokenized financial instruments across the EU, primarily most recently an issuer that has used this technology to pretty much allow exposure to UST bills and corporate bonds of some EV manufacturers in the EU, with several issuances of tokenized structured notes or structured products. There is no doubt that there is a big interest in tokenization, but we see that in some jurisdictions with the mature regulatory framework, like in the EU, going beyond this primary market and primary issues is creating a true secondary market is a much more challenging task. In your view, what's the current state of the market for tokenized securities, and what are some structural issues that still remain, and that you believe key jurisdictions need to address to unlock adoption at scale?
Yeah, we, like you noted, there's been a lot of beautiful on-ramps that have been built, right? I think we've maybe forgotten the motorway itself to build the highway. Issuance is everywhere here, and these pilot programs are exciting. You know, the World Bank has done real tokenized bonds. There's a DTCC pilot program around tokenizing treasuries that we're involved with here at Talos. You know, so can you issue a security on chain? We've answered that question. Yes, like, you know, we've proven that you can. The secondary market is where things are stalling, right? And I think we still need three things, and there's three reasons. Fragmentation is a big problem. So, you know, tokenized assets scatter across all different blockchains. They don't talk natively to each other. So you really need that infrastructure just to move between the venues. That hasn't been figured out yet. Rules have not been written. We've talked a little bit about this already. We're still in, you know, pilot program land, at least in the US. You know, the DTCC got a no action letter to even do their pilot program. These are great. It's a great step, but they're really narrow, right? So we haven't unlocked, you know, the full breadth of liquidity that you would need to go beyond a pilot program. But these things are important to test out the pipes before you do jump in. So there's some thought behind that, obviously, and some logic to start smaller. And then there's all the boring, you know, back office stuff we've been alluding to here. Settlement finality means different things on different rails, tax, reporting obligations, right? These things just haven't been mapped out yet. So, you know, issuance, I think, is solved. I think the technology itself clearly is there. Just the life cycle around the whole thing, it's just not, hasn't been fully built yet, but people are working hard towards it. And, you know, in the beginning, we talked a little bit about who can issue these as well. That's the other piece of it. You know, is it going to be on the onus on issuers themselves when you're talking purely in an equity space to be the ones that are issuing their equities on chain and tokenizing their equities? And how many issuers are willing to do that? If we live in a land where third parties can just issue Apple stock without Apple's permission, certainly there's a lot of liquidity that's added there, this big liquidity boom, and maybe that's what generates the secondary market to trade. But, you know, there's certainly downsides. What happens with, you know, voting rights? There's a whole bunch of other questions that come out of that, and I think these are just conversations that are having, and the market is trying to figure out.
Yeah, quite a few steps quite a few steps there for us, you know, to remove this term pilot, not only for the name of our statutes, but also from the operating reality when it comes to tokenizations. But from your perspective and experience, what are some steps that institutions need to take to prepare for the adoption of tokenized assets more broadly? And what are you guys at Talos doing to help them achieve this goal?
Yeah, listen, I don't think the winners are going to be decided by, you know, who has the flashiest tokenization strategy. It's going to be by who has fixed up their data and their operating model first, and it's working seamlessly. You know, the current way of doing business is not going to go away anytime soon. And that one by itself is hard to maintain. People that working in this industry obviously know these are there are a lot of really big companies that have a lot of people and a lot of processes to maintain. So, you know, you're asking institutions to really add a second rail that runs 24/7, settles instantly, and lives on multiple chains, right? Running both worlds cleanly is really the capability that matters. And this is exactly where Talos sits, right? So we are the operating system for our clients. You know, with our tools, institutions can trade and manage and settle across venues and both rails through one interface. Execution, routing, portfolio, risk, treasury, settlement, right? The goal is to allow a traditional manager to manage it all across both the current and digital operating model without leaving their system every single day. Everyone loves to talk about, you know, the front end and the app and the token and the access. The hard part is really the plumbing, right? Plumbing is profoundly boring until it breaks, both in your personal life and in your business. And it's a difficult challenge. So I think, you know, the biggest thing I would recommend is to have conversations, you know, with the players that are in the digital asset space now that are working to solve this. There's so many amazing experts across different needs that you're going to have, whether it's compliance solutions or trading solutions. And it's going to be a very difficult thing to build and maintain on your own. And there's just good companies out there that can help at least start you know your journey down this path. So start preparing, because I think as we've discussed through here, you know, I think every indication from regulators, from the largest companies in the world in the financial space, is that this is what they're moving towards, and there's a real benefit for them to do so. So I think, you know, everybody else needs to react in the same way.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, with that, we have unfortunately come to the end of our today's episode. Josh, it's been a true pleasure speaking to you about this very interesting topic that keeps the industry very busy. Thank you all for listening. If you have enjoyed the episode, feel free to subscribe to our channel to stay up to date with our forthcoming episodes that will continue to explore latest legal and regulatory developments, trends, and hot topics in the fintech sector from across the globe.